When's the last time you've thought about a chemical? Any chemical, but a chemical called ammonia. When's the last time someone's spoken to you about ammonia? If you had to go and find ammonia, what would you do? A lot of us have it as a cleaning solvent in the pantry every once in a year or so. We might buy a bottle of ammonia just to clean some glass or some floor cleaner. It's a good sort of solvent. But apart from that, it sort of is very low in our life, on our radar. It's a very low life radar. Now, if I was to tell you that the invention of ammonia and our ability to make ammonia has really changed the planet, it's fed the planet, and it's taking up 2% of our planet's energy production has gone into ammonia production, so I'm told. 2%, 1% of our carbon dioxide or carbon emissions are due to ammonia production. What's going on? And how come people don't know about it? In fact, a lot of the stuff that you are eating is built from fertilizers grown with ammonium nitrate fertilizer, and so in essence we know little about ammonia. We don't buy it, but we do buy a lot of it. We actually, all the food we buy, a large fraction of the cost of that food is the provision of artificial fertilizers. So I'm going to talk about the chemical reactions that has given us the modern day ammonia. And Peter Hill Explains Where I discuss things scientific and try and give a sort of an overview for, I suppose, school teaching. So the ammonia production process, and I'll give some of the history of it without going too deeply into it, was developed as a more or less restriction to the Great British Navy closing down the ports and the imports into Germany. And they had to produce explosives from nitrate explosives. So fertilizer explosives, you would have heard of it, and fertilizer. And so to do that, they had to actually produce ammonia. And in World War I, I think 1917, Haber and Bosch, two scientists came up with a process to make ammonium. And that ammonia reaction is... Many people think it's the most important reaction on Earth, because this reaction has allowed us to stop going around, hunting around for fertilizer, but to actually make it ourselves. So previously, if you want to be a great empire, you had to have a big empire which had far-flung colonies, which had big hills of bird poo. So the major way we got used to get guano, we used to get... fertilizer is by mining bird poo and putting it on our soils, and you'd grow your crops. And there is a lot of benefit for growing a fertilized crop. Europe has been going through a period of technological innovations to get through increase the productivity of their soil. The productivity of their soil meant not only producing more with less, but in a smaller area, so the actual number of people and it's much more efficient to have especially if you don't have transport and all that type of stuff, to have an efficient small high growth crop. So they had crop rotation, then the addition of fertilizer, and this sort of plateaued at a certain point, and then we began to make the fertilizer ourselves industrially. So a factory would produce fertilizer out of the air and the hydrogen source, which is methane, readily available gas. So we could have a rethink of that. So that produces ammonia, and ammonia is processed to produce fertilizer. So, what is so important about nitrogen? Well, nitrogen is very happy being nitrogen by itself. N2 in our atmosphere, roughly 71% of the atmosphere. I think 78%, something up around that. Most of the atmosphere Four out of every five molecules is a nitrogen. So nitrogen is in abundance, but it's all locked up. And so it's basically an inert thing, and it takes a lightning strike or a crafty bacteria, which plants hang on to and feed, to actually fix the nitrogen, to convert the nitrogen from N2 to NO3, or in some cases NH3. So ammonia tends to be a toxin, so plants tend to get rid of it, similar to the way that hydroxide, which is H2O2, is a toxin, and plants have heaps of enzymes to mop this up to get rid of that real damn quickly. So ammonia was something to manufacture. So let's look at the formula of ammonia. That's NH3. So that's three hydrogen protons at the base, a nitrogen and an electron cloud sitting above, just to give you an idea. So it's sort of like it's got a bulge of electrons, like, you know, the old style stamps, that big bulge sitting on the top, and it's got three little prongs at the bottom, like a stool with a large prong on it. And the Germans had to come up with a way to make this process. Now, just to give you an idea, this process is incredibly important, and it's seen by China as a national priority to produce as much ammonia as possible. So their production process now dwarfs the rest of the world. I think combined there's more nitrogen produced, so more ammonia produced by the Haber process in China than any other country on earth. And it's a key strategic thing to have control of. So if you have that, you can produce as much fertilizer as you want, make other countries dependent on you because they have to buy the fertilizer off you. So it's sort of the strategic equivalent of being Saudi Arabia with all the petrol. If you have all the ammonia in the world, you've got great control. So if you just type in world production of ammonia, you'll come up with this staggering list. Australia doesn't even appear on it. It goes China, United States, a few other countries, but China dwarfs the next, say, 5 or 10 nations. Look, it's been a while since I've seen this diagram, so I'm just this chart. So it's a while since I'm sort of going off memory here. I want to talk about ammonia because it is taking. I just read a New Scientist article taking 2% of the world's production. So if you'd like to say, if you say 2% is sort of out of a day, a week, say a week of your energy bills, of your whole energy bills for the day, for the year, went into, so it's 52 weeks a year, so 2% is roughly a week. A week of your energy bills goes into production of ammonia, and the ammonia you get goes to be used by plants to produce proteins. Proteins, we'll just go again, is a nitrogen, a carbon with a side chain, a carbon with an oxygen connected to another nitrogen. So that's the amino acids in a chain produce proteins, which produce all the machinery in a plant. So a plant is, yes, there's carbohydrates, but there's lots of little micro machines built out of this process, and you have to have nitrogen to produce. And of course, when you break down your proteins, you produce uric acid. I can't quite imagine the molecules you go. So nitrogen is really important. Nitrogen, fixed nitrogen, that is any nitrogen which isn't just N2, which is a really pretty inert sort of gas, so biologically active nitrogen. It's got to be bound to a hydrogen to make an amine, or to an oxygen to make a nitrite, or nitride, or nitrate. I have to remember that. I think N2 is, let's see, nitroglycerin. All nitroglycerin is one example of making explosives. So the Germans wanted to get this to make explosives and fertilizers. So they came up with the Haber process. And how do you make nitrogen? It's putting it in my head. It's nitrogen plus hydrogen goes to NH3. So let's, in your head, balance this. This is N2, a molecule of nitrogen, plus 3H2, hydrogen atoms, go to ammonia molecules, 2NH3. Now, I talk about the numbers in front, the number of molecules in front. So on the left-hand side, we've got four molecules all up. On the right-hand side, we've got two. So we've got one nitrogen, three hydrogens, goes to ammonia molecules. So a molecule is just a combination of bound atoms. So rather than individual, they've got a bound, but they can still move about in a gas. And so now this function is a... when you burn hydrogen in nitrogen, it produces heat. So why not just get a bottle of nitrogen and a bottle of hydrogen, mix the two together, light a match, and boom, it goes off. Well, it's not quite like that. There's something called a strong activation energy. That is, so you can imagine a couple which really hate each other at a distance, and you've got to get them together for an evening at close proximity, and they begin talking to each other, and they say, "Oh, you're not so bad," and they sort of couple up after that. And that's similar with nitrogen and hydrogen. You've got to push it really hard together, and then it says, "Oh, you're not so bad." So it releases heat. They have a long-term relationship, but the initial courtship requires a lot of tending to it. So this is the nature of the Haber process. There are three levers that Haber and Bosch, that's how you pronounce it. I've never had to pronounce it. And they've got Nobel Prizes for their work. It's really important work. And this is, you've got nitrogen and hydrogen, and they don't like each other from afar, but close they do bound and make this ammonia. And so there's something called, and when they do, they produce heat. There's something called the Chatelier's principle. That is, a chemical reaction goes to minimize the sources of work with it. I've got the entropy version of it in my head. But essentially, if I had a chemical reaction which produces, I'll try and make this as simple as possible. We start off with the first lever we're going to look at is at pressure. So I start off with four gas particles, and here's a little trick. Pressure is proportional to just the number of gas particles. It doesn't matter what they are, it's just the number. So if I've got oxygen, a bottle of oxygen, the same number of oxygen particles, say I've got 10 oxygen particles there, and I have it at a temperature, I look at the pressure gauge there, say the pressure for your memory brain in podcast land is 3, I then have another bottle of nitrogen, and there's 10 nitrogens, and it's at a particular temperature, say a temperature of 100, so both at 100, it will also have a pressure of 3. Same for hydrogen, same for argon, same for neon. If I have 10 neons at 100 degrees in this size bottle, it will have a pressure of 3. So the way to think of it is that I start off with four molecules at the start, and after I've done this process, I get two. And so, if you can imagine, something at high pressure is got a lot of energy. So, imagine I have a balloon, I'm blowing it up, it's higher pressure, and can release that energy by popping. So, the principle is to drive this reaction, you need a lot of pressure. So, you put it under one atmosphere, two atmosphere, keep it going. It's not going, we'll have to come back as you're loading up the atmosphere. And then, well, why not 1,000 atmospheres? Yeah, 1,000 atmospheres, it will go from the left-hand side to the right-hand, the Chatelier's principle, I can pronounce that a bit now. And so you want to go really high pressure. Now, the thing is that you've got a cost of causing it. So the cost to go up to pressure is not a linear cost. So if you double the pressure, initially it will cost double the cost. So if we go for, to give you numbers ahead, say if I want to increase a body of pump gas from one atmosphere to two atmospheres. Now, I just want to think of my the car tire pressure. I think it's about 2.5 atmospheres. If I want to increase the pressure by from one atmosphere to two atmospheres, say it costs me $10. Say if I want to increase it to three atmospheres pressure, it will cost me $10 plus $11, which is okay. But say if I want to increase it to four atmospheres, it will cost $10 plus $11 plus, say, $15. So the cost of doing the pressure increases not proportional to the amount of pressure, but to more, because you have to buy more expensive fittings. You have to build everything more bulky to take this enormous pressure. So although you can imagine the highest pressure, that the most economical pressure is for the Haber process. So the Haber process, nitrogen, hydrogen, ammonia produced, pressure. Pressure is increased 180 atmospheres, 200, 240, around 200 atmospheres. We'll take that as the average pressure. So you have to design and build pressure systems that will work forever and a day. So this is one of the things. You can build two cost-competitive high-pressure systems. It's just whether they will last long and as long and be efficient overall. So the unit of pressure which has been used since the end of World War One is 200 atmospheres. Now look at temperature. Now, temperature, the very same thing goes. If it releases heat, the higher temperatures are worse. So let's go for cold temperature. But if you know something, if you are cooling something, or cooling an egg at very low temperature, it takes a long, long time, and time is money. So another compromise has to go across. And so you could heat it up to 1,000 degrees, and it would react really quickly, but it would have a very small yield. You could run it at ice temperature, but it would take... All these things are not linear. One day it takes, say, you have it going for one day. You halve the pressure. It's not 2 days; it's 100 days. And if you have 0 degrees, it will take thousands of years to operate. So you've got to go up in temperature to reduce the time. So every time you go up in temperature, the actual yield produced by Le Chatelier's principle, giving an exothermic reaction, producing heat, reduces down. So atmosphere with this compromise, again, in terms of temperature, there's also a compromise. So again, to make everything easy, 200 atmospheres, roughly 400 degrees Celsius. So that is quite hot. It's sort of reddish hot. And then things... you can get this next version, the trio of things that you're going through to get just right. I was going to say probably four things, but three things. You add iron as a catalyst, and you can well think of a process taking up 2% of the world's energy to feed the entire planet. So our population has increased easily about sevenfold since World War One. It's a sort of incredible increase in our population. It's now leveling off, and we could go into that. But to get that sevenfold increase, and we're now living on easily more than the surface area of our planet to survive. So obviously we're going to have to make our land more productive. And so this is based on this trio of things: 200 atmospheres, 400 degrees Celsius, and iron catalysts, or Fe catalysts. Now, the important thing is that I would expect that there's going to be, unless there's some new super material, I think they would have tried every catalyst in the periodic table. What there could well be is a catalyst which will work at, say, higher pressure, or a catalyst which will work at lower pressure, or lower temperature, or higher temperature. Now, the thing is that you put in your nitrogen and hydrogen. You make the hydrogen by cracking or burning methane with insufficient oxygen. If you provide methane and just give it all the oxygen it needs, it will say, thank you very much, I'll make carbon dioxide and water. But if you give it not enough oxygen and it's hot enough, it will produce hydrogen and carbon monoxide. And then you have to react the carbon monoxide further with oxygen, which is produced. So it's a sort of a process to produce heaps of hydrogen. Now this is sort of gut-wrenching, because it was producing greenhouse gas when you could have a nuclear reactor producing electricity, which cracks the hydrogen with electricity, water with electricity. I'm just trying to think. I think it's not methane and reduced oxygen. I think it's actually methane and steam go together, because now I can visualize that. You've got oxygen with a heap of hydrogens going across, so the hydrogens get ripped off the oxygen, and the hydrogen gets ripped off the carbon in order to form that base reaction. I would think it's not reduced oxygen, it's probably methane and oxygen. Methane is CH4, it's a basic gas, which again, I suppose the Germans would have got from cracking coal. That's heating up coal very hot, and breaking it down with the catalyst produces lots of methane. Because I'm not sure whether World War One Germany had huge supplies of methane. Okay, so you've got the hydrogen and the nitrogen, and you pump it into this process. It goes full bottle, and it's produced. Say you start off with 10 units of nitrogen and hydrogen, and it will go fully. You'll wind up with 10 units of nitrogen and hydrogen and 1 unit of methane, methane, which is NH3. Now that is as far as it's going to go. What you can do is that you can do things like increase the pressure, but that means more money from the investors, or you can increase the temperature, or reduce the temperature. It means that you have to wait a long time. So there's a compromise here. And so what's done is the gas is taken away from the hot source, and possibly at high pressure, I don't know where, whatever happens, or it's expanded the, if you let it expand, the ammonia, I don't know what that said, methane before, the ammonia will come out as a cloud, or drop, start to sprinkle out, and then you can re-harvest that waste gas, you can re-harvest that gas and push it in. So the Haber process is not this magic bullet. It's a compromised process on several times. Compromised pressure, compromised temperature. The catalyst is as good as it gets. And then a process which is not 100% of the way through, but it produces a yield, and that yield is removed. So if you remove the product and put everything back again, the equation will continue to go through. You sort of milk it a nitrogen. A ammonia milking of this process. So this is a major, major world process. It feeds the planet. It supplies explosives and fertilizers. It's sort of the backbone of our modern civilization. You yourself are responsible. That's you consume a heap of ammonia. But it's ammonia you feed the ammonia into fertilizer, which feeds the plants, which feeds you. So although you physically, in your world, have only ammonia in microscopic concentrations in a bottle underneath your sink. If you pan out to space and look at the global situation, we as a planet are producing buckets and buckets of ammonia, and we have a more fertile planet than it has ever been. Of course, it's also wrecking the environment. The nitrates are going into the water, going in, creating blooms, creating a whole series of cascades of things which may do things like destroy the barrier reef. And this, so farmers get their yield because the fertilizer is cheap. If you think about it, if you're going to cut down an acre, it's much better to cut down an acre and have it fertilized than have 10 acres of cleared land. It's sort of hard to work through. One of the things is that people say, oh, have cropped land. Now, cropped lands use fertilizers, whereas pasture land, there's not this entire need to use as much fertilizer. But I could be proven wrong. I could well imagine in some of these places they sprinkle fertilizer on top of their pastures to make them grow enormously well. And of course, we have the problem is that a lot of that fertilizer, some of it goes into the food, a lot of it gets washed straight into streams. And so there's many points that we could improve our impact on the planet, i.e. getting a more carbon-friendly way of making nitrogen fertilizer. Yeah, that's a 1%, which I think we could easily look at. Possibly paying a bit more for, if we paid a bit more for our food, we could, turn off 1% of our carbon emission overnight, one would expect. And then there's the politics of it, China having all the ammonia production, and what's doing this whole series of geopolitical scale things doing, because it is a global chemical reaction. So let's just repeat the numbers once again, because that's what I do to burn the numbers into my head. And I'll share with you that I'm podcasting this much and this quickly just to achieve cognitive power, being able to speak more clearly, assess information, sort of let the information, I'll talk about the Haber process, not think for a while, just let the information just flow into my head that I've remembered it, and then put it out. But part of it is going through those numbers. I can imagine the chemical reactions, the principles. Look, the principle, Le Chatelier's principle, that is the equilibrium of a chemical reaction will go to with temperature and pressure to minimize the energy of both. So if you've got more particles on the left-hand side and the right-hand side, increase the pressure. That's the way to go. If energy is produced and the temperature will increase, go for a lower temperature. So the Chatelier's principle, then there's economic compromise with it, and then let's go through and ammonia, the structure of the ammonia molecule and its use, and the fact that we need to fix nitrogen, make it biologically accessible, and then let's go through the numbers. 2% of the world's energy output is put into this process. The greatest greenhouse gas production is 1% is due to this process, so I'm told. The concentration of ammonia production is with the big powers of Earth. 200 atmospheres, 400 degrees Celsius, an iron catalyst, a process of milking the ammonia to drive the reaction continuously forward. You take the product away the entire time. It's sort of like you've got a chicken and you remove the egg so it keeps on laying the egg. So they're the processes for it. And the idea of Peter Hill Explains is for you to refresh and look through the process. You may know it already, or it may spark enough questions for you to look at it, and for me to get used to explaining things off the top of my head, just get back my cognitive speed and agility ready for return to work after my series of fairly serious cardiac operations. Thanks for listening, and in the meantime, keep on doing science, thinking science, and when it all makes sense, teaching science. Thanks for listening.